ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Peter Martin, host of The Economy Stupid, where we find economics in relationships.
She only wants a man if he's really, really good.
In the Reserve Bank board.
I knew. Everybody on the board knew recession was coming.
And in food.
It's about the cup of diesels required through the life cycle to get that chicken patty on your burger.
The Economy Stupid. Search for The Economy Stupid on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is The Book Show, where today I'm bringing you conversations with two beloved writers, a Pulitzer Prize winner and a Miles Franklin winner. I'm Claire Nichols. Wonderful to be with you today. Later, Amanda Laurie will be here. She won the Miles Franklin for her novel The Labyrinth, about a woman building a stone labyrinth in a coastal town. But now Amanda is moving into unexpected territory with a novel about people who claim to have been abducted by aliens. You're going to have to stick around for that. But first, I am so pleased to say that the American author Elizabeth Strout is here. She's the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer behind the iconic characters Olive Kitteridge and Lucy Barton. And in her latest novel, she brings us a new character to fall in love with, an aging Massachusetts high school history teacher called Artie Dam. Now, from the outside, Artie's life seems pretty normal and pretty good. He's had a long marriage, he's got a grown son, a great relationship with his students. But inside, Artie is starting to unravel. The book is called The Things We Never Say. Elizabeth Strout, welcome back to The Book Show.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you very, very much for having me again.
We're really happy to have you. You have such a talent for names, Elizabeth. Olive Kitteridge is obviously so fantastic. In this book, I loved the names Flossie McDonald, Endicott Peabody. No one will be surprised to know that Endicott Peabody sucks. How do you know when you've landed on the perfect name?
I don't know, but names are very important. I have learned that. I learned that right back with Amy and Isabel when I discovered that young girl's name was Amy, then I could write her. And I didn't know it, you know. Anyway, so names are very important to me, and I'm not sure how I came up with Artie. I know I came up with Dam. I had seen, somebody had sent me an obituary from the 1960s or 70s. I mean, this friend of mine who does these weird things. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But I do remember seeing a man called Dam with two M's, and he looked so pleasant, and he had these big wire-frame glasses, and he just looked so ordinary and so pleasant, and his last name was Dam, D-A-M-M, and that just kept going round and round in my head, and I don't even remember what his obituary said he did, but finally Artie Dam came to me as this character. But I do think the first germ was, you know, the photo that I had seen from the obituary.
Those wireframe glasses, that kind of gentle personality.
Really, really lovely and so ordinary looking. Unassuming.
You've changed his Dam to Dam with one M.
Right, yeah.
And his students like to call him Dam Dam, which is pretty cute.
Yeah. Well, I think I had his name Dam. I just didn't want the two M's originally. So I come up with a little story of why he dropped one of the M's, you know, in the book. He and his son explain it to the son's wife. But I just thought it was a better name, Artie, D-A-M. And then I began to think, wait, these students have had him for years. He's been known as Dam Dam, probably. So, you know, going way back, not currently. It's not so much a contemporary student would have called him that, except they do because that's what he's known as.
Mm-hmm. And he is this high school history teacher. His students like him. He's been teacher of the year. I mean, this is a good man. And you've told me before, Elizabeth, that you always have to fall in love with your characters in order to write them. So tell us all. Tell us who this man is and why you love Artie Dam.
Oh, because he's Artie. I mean, because I feel like I know him so well. You know, he's the last full character that I've written, and so he's still fresh in my mind, and I just find him to be fundamentally so decent and just kind of bumbling through his life as we all do, and then coming across things that confuse him as we all do. And then he begins to figure stuff out. He begins to understand a little bit more than he did at the beginning of the book.
Mm. It's fair to say that when the book opens, though, he is in a pretty dark place. Tell me where Artie's head's at when this book opens.
Well, Artie is feeling, for him, quite unnaturally lonely at that point. And then I hope that the stage has been set for the reader to ultimately understand why. Because without him even knowing, and yet the reader has to understand a little bit, that his wife has been separating herself from him in little ways every so often as she goes through her own thing. And then his son has very much been distancing himself for a number of months. And these things make Artie feel very sad, really quite sad. And then he finds out why. And also, you know, when his life is saved by that, I mean, he's realized, oh, I didn't want to die. I just didn't want to live at that moment. But he's fully back engaged in life.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So you just dropped that little teaser there, when his life is saved by that man. Do you want to tell us what happens there?
Well, you know, Artie, he's been thinking these miserable thoughts, but he doesn't act on them. And then he actually has an accident in the water, and this man ends up saving his life. And in the hospital, Artie realizes, oh my goodness, I didn't want to die. I just didn't want to live. At that moment, he hadn't wanted to live. But, and then he's fully, fully back in life, and life begins to hand him some real surprises.
It's a really surprising piece of plotting, Elizabeth, to have a man at the start of chapter one who thinks he might not want to live, but by the start of chapter two has changed his mind. And then we have a whole book to go. Normally that would happen in the last chapter.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. I wrote this book. I mean, this was a book that came out almost the way it was written. I rewrote many scenes and stuff like that, but I actually began that first paragraph when he's eating with Flossie. That was the first paragraph I began with, because I wanted the reader to hear the word jovial. Like, she says to him, please stay jovial, always stay jovial. And I think Artie has always thought of himself as jovial. Other people have thought of him as jovial. And then we find out, oh my word, he's not jovial right now. And then he has to, you know, build back his life somehow. And so I was interested that I did that at the beginning. I wrote about him so lonely. But then when the writing goes really well for me, I realize, and it's always intriguing to me, that I've almost left little clues for myself in the text. And it was sitting right there. I mean, the moment he comes back from dinner with Flossie and we realize, oh, the wife doesn't like Flossie. And then I thought, oh yeah, okay. Boom, boom. And then, you know, when I got to this son, I realized, wow, okay, let's do this.
It sounds so exciting, like this journey of discovery that you're going on. So like when you started, what did you have? You had the name, you had the wireframe glasses, but did you know what Artie's journey would be?
No, I did not. I did not. And I was interested to find out.
Artie is really caught up with this idea of free will. He's wondering if we ever really make our own choices. Why was free will on your mind when writing this book?
I don't know, but that's one of the things that came up about Artie. Like, he's at the party and he's asking Hoover Lakeland, you know, do you think there's an, and I thought, oh, how intriguing. And I think it's just because he is beginning to have interior changes, you know, instead of just being jovial, already going through his life, he's beginning to question things and think about things in a whole new way. And it seemed to me, you know, he's studied history and yet he's actually wondering, I wonder if we have free will. You know, it's not like he's the smartest man in the world, but he's perfectly intelligent, but he's not super brainy like his son is. But, you know, I just thought it was interesting to see him wonder about that and then follow through with it.
And I find it extra fascinating because, of course, we know that Artie Dam is a character in a novel that you are writing, Elizabeth Strout. So really, free will, well, you're in control of his life.
I know, but it doesn't really feel like it when I'm writing it. I mean, I know that I'm writing his life. I do understand that I'm doing it, but I do. The more I get to know my characters, the more they tell me what they're going to do and how they're going to be.
Do they surprise you?
Oh, they do all the time. Oh, yeah. If I wasn't surprised, you wouldn't be surprised. So, yeah, every day we're surprised. Yeah.
I do think you're playing with that idea, though. You know, we've got Artie talking about free will, and then you have these kind of little flourishes in the book where you'll occasionally jump forward and tell us this is what will happen to this character.
Yeah.
So that idea of things being fated or things being decided or characters actually having no control, you're kind of playing with that, aren't you?
I guess so. I didn't think of that, but thank you. I don't know. I just did it. But they do seem to go to their fates. As Artie says himself, toward the end of the book, he realizes I'm something's happening to me, and I will just go to my fate, which is a way of saying that, you know, he didn't have as much free will as he thought, maybe.
The timing of this book is really important, Elizabeth Strout. It opens just before the 2024 presidential election. It's certainly on Artie's mind and on the mind of the people around him. Can you tell me what you remember about this time before Trump was elected for a second time?
Well, I was writing the book at that time. Mm. I was literally writing it in real time. And, you know, when I first wrote Amy and Isabel, I realized literature is about place and about time in history. And if you have a place and a time in history and you throw in a character, then you're going to have a story. I realized this is Artie's time in history. And because he's a history teacher, it's even going to mean more to him than it might another person on the street. So that is what I was doing.
I should mention that Trump is never named in this book, but it's very clear who you're writing about. At one point, one of the characters says, you know, he's going to win. And he says, people want authority. They crave authority. And she doesn't have the kind that they want, and he does. That was such a fascinating line. So again, if this is written in real time, this was you figuring this out as well, Elizabeth?
I think that was a thought that I had during one of the debates. I remember thinking, oh, wow, this is so fascinating. Because I mean, even in a Lucy Barton book, I had mentioned how people crave authority. Mm-hmm. And I've understood that as a writer, like to write something, you must write with authority. The authority that you bring to the page will mean more to the reader without them even knowing it than almost anything. So I have many different concepts of authority, you know, running around in my head. But I did think that at one of their debates, I realized, wow, he has what people will feel is authority.
And then the election happened in your writing process. The election happens on the book. I think it's two sentences that basically say the election happened. Half the people were very happy, half the people were not very happy. And then what does that mean for you when you're writing this book? Do you go, okay, well, I guess we're going into Trump era number two?
Yeah, exactly. And I just kept writing it as it was taking place. I mean, I did flash forward. And those things actually came true. Like there were protesters that were shot, not at the time that I was writing it because the book was done, but I did flash forward, you know, so I knew that would happen.
That is unbelievable. I was thinking about the fact of you trying to keep up with history, right? So you talk in the book, Artie notices, you know, ICE officers on the street. They're talking about the war in Gaza. Obviously, the war in Iran is not there because the book was published.
Yeah.
But in it, what seems from this side of the world a very unpredictable time in American history.
Well, horrifying.
How do you know when to actually stop writing, and how do you know that what you've written will be dated in, you know, 2 months' time?
Exactly, and I hope it's not. Mm. I mean, because it stops. The book stops. You know, at a certain point, I realized, okay, this is Artie's time in history has passed. History has rolled over him, you know, even with the AI and the students and, you know, the new principal, and just his time in history is done. And so Artie had to be done.
Do you think this is the most political book you've written?
I think that The Burgess Boys was, you know, pretty political book. I mean, dealing with the Somalis having moved to the state of Maine. But I think this is, again, I just keep going back to the time in history. I mean, this is a very, very strange time in history. And if I'm going to write a book that takes place in this time, then I, especially with a history teacher, I need to include as much as, you know, as I can take or the reader can take.
And what is that line? Because I was thinking, you know, writing this all down can be a little depressing. Is it depressing for you, or does it help you kind of get it out what you need to say by putting it on the page?
Well, I think by the time the book was done, I think we were just really sliding into further chaos. And so, you know, but I have been deeply saddened, I think is the word, you know, every day, just sad.
You were talking about, you know, you're saying books are about a time. They're also about a place. This one is set in Massachusetts, just a little down the coast from Maine, where we've read so much of your fiction. Yeah. What's the relevance of this place to the story?
Well, you know, I mean, I know Massachusetts. I mean, I used to live in Boston many years ago, and so Massachusetts is not that far from me, but culturally it's very different. And my husband and I drove down there. We took a 2 or 3 day drive along the coast of Massachusetts because I always need visuals. I need to see, you know, the place that Artie might live, the private road. You know, I actually saw the man, Endicott Peabody. I saw him with his golf bags. I thought, okay, that's perfect. There goes Endicott. Perfect. You know, so I had to see these things. And one of the things that I saw there, which I had not remembered, and I'm glad we went, which you don't see in Maine, are in the towns, you see these great big houses that are very close to the sidewalks because they're so old that the sidewalks, you know, were further away back when the house was originally built and the streets have gotten a little wider. So these big old houses are really close to the sidewalks, and that kind of thing was visually very important for me to capture.
What about the character of the place?
It's got its own vibe, you know, like, I mean, America has so many, it's just got endless vibes going on, obviously, but it's got its own, you know, kind of thing going on. And we drove around different high schools and, you know, I finally found the one that I thought Artie would teach at.
That must be so, so special and so exciting. Like, do you take a picture? Do you write something down? What do you do when you see that place?
I'm taking notes all the time. Yeah.
This is fun. On page 33 of The Things We Never Say, there's a very cute little call out. Artie remembers a book his wife once read about a crotchety woman from Maine. I laughed at this, Elizabeth Strout, because you're clearly referencing your own book in Olive Kitteridge. It must be pretty cool to have a character that is so well known that you can give yourself a little shout out in your book.
Well, I mean, I don't know if people will get it or not. It doesn't really matter if they don't. I mean, the point is made anyway. But it did occur to me in some like far back part of my mind. I thought, I bet Evie's been in a book club where they probably had to read that book. So, you know what?
And, you know, it is lovely to meet a new character in this book, in Artie Dam, to have a novel that stands alone from that world of Olive Kitteridge and Lucy Barton. Are you done with Olive and Lucy, or are we going to see more of them?
I think that I'm done, but I have said that every single time I finished a book about them. So I've learned now I don't dare say anything. I feel like I'm done, but I'm not going to say that I'm done. I don't dare say anything.
Was it fun to step outside that world and do something completely new?
Yes, it was very, very refreshing. I just thought, okay, goodbye, Crosby. Let's just turn around and go back, you know, down the coast to see what else we can find in a whole new world and cast of characters. So that was, it was very cleansing for me in a way.
Well, it's a beautiful book. It's called The Things We Never Say. It's published by Penguin Random House. Elizabeth Strout, how wonderful to talk to you again today.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to talk to you. I really appreciate it very much.
You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Claire Nichols. And Amanda Laurie is here now. She won the Miles Franklin Award in 2021 for The Labyrinth. That was one of a trio of so-called pastoral novels about people moving from the city to the country. Now, for her latest book, Amanda has shifted her focus to outer space, kind of. Capture introduces us to a psychiatrist, Jim, who sits down with people who say they've been abducted by aliens. Hi, Amanda.
Hello.
This is such a surprising turn from the pastoral trio. How did you find yourself learning about people's alien experiences?
Well, I was watching a documentary on dreams, and it was looking into the difference between dreams and, say, hallucinations or visions or other kinds of experiences. And it mentioned the work of a distinguished American psychiatrist, John Mack, who's long dead, and who was a professor of psychiatry at Harvard, very respectable man. And he had conducted research into people who claimed to be aliens, or rather to have been abducted by aliens. And he ended up believing them. Mm. And so Harvard sacked him. He got a good lawyer and got himself reinstated on the grounds of free speech, which in those days was at the core of American rights, not so much now. And I didn't want to write a novel based on John Mack. The main character in Capture is in no way like him, other than that he's a distinguished psychiatrist. But I started thinking about something that's always interested me, preoccupied me since I was young, and that is the question, philosophical question of doubt. How do we know what we know? How can we be certain that what we know is true? And it seemed to me, particularly when I was young and I taught politics in a university, that the ability psychologically to live with doubt and uncertainty to a degree is the basis of all civilized behavior. But it can become a kind of psychological burden, and we can often kind of take a flight into certainty. You see that on both sides of the political spectrum. Mm. People who are absolutely certain about a great deal won't enter into any debate about it. So I wanted to find a way in fiction to write about radical doubt. How do we live with it? What happens when we're confronted with it in a really extreme form, which in this case is very extreme? There's probably no more extreme form than the question of aliens, simply because we can't prove they exist, but we can't prove that they don't exist. Mm. So I set up my character, Jim Mather, and he has these people who don't suffer from mental illness. They have good jobs, they are functional in their lives, they're good parents, and they tell him these extraordinary stories. Is he going to believe them?
Before you embarked on this project, Amanda, where did you stand on alien experiences? Were you a skeptic?
I had what I think is the only sensible point of view, which I might add is shared by most scientists, which is we don't know. Mm. We have no way of knowing, and it would be fruitless to be dogmatic either way on yes or no. We just don't know. I mean, unhappily, I've never met an alien.
Unhappily?
You know, as you get older, you want to have more interesting experiences in life. I've never seen a UFO. I've got a friend who claims to have seen one. No, it wasn't. It did not in any way come out of a personal experience in that sense.
So you haven't had the personal experience, so I guess you've had to do research. Like, what kind of research did you do for this?
Well, not much really. I read a couple of books of people talking about their experiences, and as all writers do, you know, we're bowerbirds and magpies. We pick the bits we want to go into our particular mosaic, and we don't want other people's ideas to dictate the form, because we're starting with our own ideas and preoccupations. So after I got the gist of the spectrum of experiences, which is actually quite narrow, many of the people who claim to have had these experiences have remarkably similar experiences, I thought, okay, I've got enough now. I've got enough to do the work I need to do.
What surprised me, Amanda, is I would consider myself very skeptical about these sorts of stories. But as I read this book and as these various patients came in to talk to Jim, I found myself wanting to believe them. I found myself wanting these stories to be true, and I didn't expect that.
Well, that's good. I'm pleased about that because as the writer, I want you to be at least open to the possibility. Otherwise, there's no point in reading the novel. You know, I want you to have to think about it and wonder. Wonder is a wonderful quality in narrative. If there's not some of it there, I think the story soon goes flat, the telling goes flat. But also the accounts by these people, experiences as they are known, are interweaved with dialogues between the psychiatrist and his research assistant, Lucy Cheng, young single mother with a degree in the history of anxiety. And those conversations they have in a local cafe are meant to highlight really a lot of the bizarre elements of life in general, not just aliens, but the way we live now.
You've said to me before, you know, all your writing is about the way we live now. And of course, you've said that this book, you know, is playing with ideas of doubt. But what other things were you looking to explore in this book about the way we live now?
Well, so much. Partly our relationship with technology. Mm-hmm. Our fears and anxieties around technology, our response to various crises as we perceive them. I mean, there's a part of the novella deals with the question of are we overpopulated or are we underpopulated? Some of our responses to current dilemmas verge, I think, on almost clinical insanity. If you look at them objectively. And some of our political movements, I think, make people who claim to have been abducted by aliens look rather moderate. So I wanted to juxtapose a whole lot of what's going on now, which I find endlessly fascinating, of course, but also to follow this character through to the end. And the critical question is, how does he judge these people? How does he judge what's before his eyes? And how does this affect him personally and his idea of himself?
Well, maybe we should say a little bit more about who this man is. His name is Jim, as we've said. At one point, he does think that fiction, Amanda, lacks substance. I was wondering if that told us everything we need to know about this man.
I couldn't resist that. I think 70% of novel readers or fiction readers are women, as estimated by research. And I have been told by men that, more than one man, that they don't read fiction because they find there's not enough substance in it. And I was once told by a lovely man who I greatly admired that he loved reading the biographies of writers because they're such fascinating people. But he didn't read their novels because he found them lightweight. So that was just a very minor observation. I was having a bit of fun with that.
So why does he take on the project?
Well, it tells you that at the beginning of the book, that he's been involved in a long research project on the suicide of young men, which has really got him down. And a friend, an old friend and colleague, persuades him to do something different. And he thinks this will help to cheer him up. You know, he says this will be a project of profound silliness. And it turns out to be anything but.
So we were talking at the start of the conversation about this idea of doubt. How much does this experience of hearing from these patients destabilize Jim? You know, how does this experience of doubt kind of unsettle him?
Well, it makes him have to interrogate his former certainties. I want the reader to keep wondering all the way through, is he going to believe these people or is he not? It's an important question. You know, I just want the reader to get to the last page. I don't mind if someone doesn't like one of my books. I just want them to keep reading. I've succeeded if they get to the last page, right? I don't know about you, but I quite often abandon books these days. So there has to be this sense of intrigue and suspense. This is a highly rational man, full of certainty. although he prides himself on having an open mind. So where's he going to go with this?
Mm. We spoke last time, Amanda Laurie, about your novel, The Conversion, which I really loved. It was about a woman who moves to the country and is in the process of converting an old church into a home. And, you know, we talked a lot about religion and secularity. Looking at this book next to that, it made me think about belief. In a secular world, is believing in aliens maybe something that's a bit more appealing for us? Is it just scratching that itch of believing in something that is greater than ourselves?
Well, you can believe in anything that you want to believe in, and you can have theories about it. The confronting thing about this particular issue, and there are other similar issues, is you're dealing with people's actual experience. And how do you assess that? How do you judge that? So much of the way in which we operate in life is based on reasonable doubt. You know, juries judge their peers on the basis of reasonable doubt. We, in our relationship with friends and lovers, we give them the benefit of the doubt. That's a very important phrase, I think, in our culture. So what we choose to believe says a lot about who we are and where we are at that point in our lives. But some things you just cannot be certain about. And then how do you deal with that psychologically?
Mm. Another big idea that comes up in this book is this idea of pronatalism. You referred to it earlier. You know, is the world overpopulated or is it underpopulated? Can you just explain, Amanda Laurie, what pronatalism is?
Well, one of the things that abductees claim happens to them is that they are used to breed a hybrid race because the Earth is in danger and the aliens want to breed a new race and help to save it. That's just one of the scenarios that comes up in the actual research. But there's also, in many countries in the world now, the pronatalist movement, which has looked at the figures and said there are not too many people on the world. We are actually faced with population decline. There are many countries in the world which will soon not have a taxation base sufficient to keep society going. Mm. It's going to be all old people because young people are not having children. And these people organise themselves into a movement to have, in which each couple will have as many children as they can, as quickly as they can, and preferably children who are genetically screened by modern technology to have no weaknesses and high IQs. Now, on paper, it sounds fairly rational, but when you look at how it works in practice, it's kind of mad. Elon Musk is a subscriber to the pronatalist movement. I think he has currently 13 children.
My research is telling me maybe now 14.
Well, who could keep up with Elon Musk? I mean, really. And is he at home to any of them? Yeah. One wonders, you know, kicking a football around, you know, you doubt it. And many subscribers to this movement are Silicon Valley types, right? And they occupy what I think of as a state of mad rationalism, where they work everything out and they freeze their embryos and then they have their embryos checked scientifically for favourable attributes, and then they have a table of favourable attributes. So when the woman goes in to have her embryo implanted, she takes number one on the list. I'm not making this up. This is how it works. So I wanted to juxtapose certain social movements alongside the madness of alien abduction and saying, look, who's mad here? Who's really mad here?
For other people that go to see Jim, you know, they seem to be very concerned about the state of the planet. They've got a lot of fears about the future. And one of the theories he pursues for a while is, you know, this is all stems from fears about, you know, environmental degradation, right?
Yes. And it may be it does. It may be that, you know, daily we are exposed to lurid dramas about the end of the planet. And he speculates that maybe this is a compensatory fantasy of a higher power that's going to rescue us.
Mm. Amanda Laurie, it's not so long since you and I chatted about your last book, The Conversion. I think that was at the end of 2023. We talked about that. The Labyrinth was not long before that. It seems like you work quite fast. Is writing easy for you?
No. On the contrary, I find it very difficult. I think the secret to that observation is that I'm writing shorter books.
Right.
The capture is, I think, 50,000 words. I like short books. I like books that do a lot in a short space. That's what I like as a reader. So naturally, that's the way I tend to go as a writer. There's so much around us now. There's so much to read. There's so much to absorb. So that a very long book has to be very special to compel our attention to the very end, I think.
And you were saying to me earlier that you found yourself abandoning a lot of books of late. Do you think that is due to the quality of books you're reading? Do you think it's due to where you're at in your reading life? What do you think is going on there?
I think it's the combination of factors. I think it's my age. I'm in my 70s. So I'll sometimes pick up a book that I think is very well written, but it's about something that I would have been preoccupied with in my 20s, but I'm kind of past that now. Mm-hmm. I think also there's a lot of undisciplined writing. There's too much description. Not enough happens. There's a lot of wordiness. I think editors could be a little more stern with young writers.
I agree.
I'll often read a page and I'll think, this person's a very gifted writer. They've made 5 or 6 good observations and come up with some lovely poetic phrases. And now an editor needs to say, you've got too many, they're cancelling each other out, pick the 2 that really land, cut the rest, right? So once I start to read with my editing pencil, the writer has lost me.
Yeah. Are you pretty strict with your own work? You know, are you reading it with that sort of kind of eagle eye when you're looking at your own stuff?
All the time. I just cut and cut and cut and cut. And sometimes you can cut too much. And once you learn this, you learn to give, once you've got a publisher and an editor you trust, you give them some stuff you've cut and you say, I don't think this belongs, but what do you think?
And what do they say to that?
Mostly they agree with me.
Do you find you're still finding things to learn about the process at this stage in your career?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you wouldn't do it if you weren't learning. You'd be bored. There'd be no point. No writer wants to do the same thing over and over, and there's always a new thought, a new problem, and you think, could this work? I mean, one of the problems I had with Capture was, if you read the accounts of people who claim to have been abducted, after a while you get very sick of them. Mm-hmm. So you have to make a decision, right, how many can I write about before the reader is just going to get sick of these people, you know? So there's just ordinary structural decisions like that when you write something unorthodox, and this is what keeps you interested.
Do you know, I must say, at the start of the book, Jim says he's going to interview, I think it's about 25 patients. And I thought, oh gosh, I hope I don't have to read 25 accounts. But it's actually more like about 5 or 6, isn't it, that
yes,
we read?
Yeah. That's enough. I've picked kind of 5 or 6 reasonably typical ones who are all different. And I thought, I'm always my own reader. I'm thinking, how much of this could I take? and that's when I stop.
Well, you always take such good care of us, and I really found this book really fascinating. It's called Capture. It's published by Text. Amanda Laurie, it's always so great to talk to you.
Thanks, Claire.
You've been listening to The Book Show. Hugest thanks to producers Sarah Lestrange and Anita Barrow. We work together on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. Now, if you are in Sydney or in Margaret River, there's some writers' festivals coming up where you can come and see me at Margaret River on the 16th and 17th of May. I'll be speaking to the Booker winner, David Saloy, and also to the Booker shortlister, Susan Choi, and the Aussie actor turned writer, Brian Brown. In Sydney the following week, I'll be sitting down with Florence Knapp, famous for The Names, and Jan Martel, who made his name all those years ago with The Life of Pi. And then for those of you in Perth, on the 27th of May, I'll be hosting a talk with the Slow Horses writer, Mick Herron, at the State Library. Lots coming up, and I would really love to see you there. Live events are so fun. For those of you who miss them, don't worry, you will hear all these conversations here on The Book Show. There has never been a better time to follow the show on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.